Hello. Welcome to this webinar series on self-care, resiliency, and compassion fatigue in educational services. My name is Françoise Mathieu, and I'm a mental health professional. I've worked in the field of mental health for over 22 years, and my areas of interest have always been issues related to trauma, stress, and crisis management. I'll tell you a bit more about this as we go on, but that's my quick intro. I also wanted to let you know that I'm on the mend from one of the nastiest flu, bronchitis, bugs I've ever had, and although I feel completely back to myself, my voice may sound a little funky, and that's why. I was supposed to record these a week ago. I had no voice at all, so this is what you get. This webinar series was designed specifically for EAs, TAs, BTAs, DCEs, CYWs, and all of you who work in educational services and student support in the province. I've had the privilege of meeting many folks who work in educational services across Ontario over the past few years, from Chatham to Peel to Toronto, Durham, Frontenac region, where I'm based. I'm based in Kingston. In February, I did half a day training with EAs in Belleville and then in Kingston at the Catholic School Board, and I heard many similar concerns to what you shared with us in the survey. Pat Fisher and I wanted to thank all of you who took the time to fill out the pre-webinar survey and share with us your very thoughtful comments and observations about the complex challenges of your work. And please know that we truly recognize that these webinars are not meant to be a magic solution to the very complex realities and challenges of your very important work, but we do believe that they are a critical part of addressing one of the essential pillars of staying well while doing this very challenging work. And that pillar is employee health and wellness, as I'll explain a little bit later in the webinar series. To use an analogy, these webinars aim to address one of the legs of the chair, if you will. This does not mean that we ignore the other three legs of the chair or that they're not equally important, but it's an essential piece of the foundation, and we hope that through these you will be able to find some strategies that you can implement no matter where you work. So let's get started. I'll tell you a little bit more about us and what we do, and then I will talk to you a little bit about the strategies we've developed we'll talk about that over the next 12 webinars. So first of all, since you can't see me right now except hear my weird little voice, obviously you can tell my name is French. I'm originally from Montreal, although I have lived in Kingston for over 23 years now, raised both my kids here. My son is graduating from grade 12 as we speak, hopefully, in a month. And my daughter is now, she's 20, and she moved on and went away after, went to university in Nova Scotia after graduating and living in Kingston her whole life. So here we go. This is me. As you can see, I do a lot of training. I'm on the road probably from September until June almost every week, working with a huge variety of professionals in what we call high stress, high trauma exposed work environments. That includes people in the field of education, law enforcement, healthcare, social services, the refugee board. It's incredible the number of people who've come out of the woodwork in the last kind of 15 years that we've been doing some of the training who talk about the really challenging elements of their jobs, and also how the work has changed over the years. So some of you have been around for a while, and I'm sure that you, if we were having a face-to-face conversation, you would agree that the nature of the work has changed, not just in the volume, but also in the complexity of the cases we're faced with. So these are the questions we became really interested in at TEND, and this is a picture of our website. We're a team of eight professionals. Most of us are mental health professionals. We do have one member of our team who is a conflict resolution mediating expert. She works with the military. And the rest of us have worked in a variety of environments, from domestic violence shelters to the prison system to children's aid to education. We have a person who's an ECE who works with us in children's mental health. So basically, all of us have they have their own pursuits, they have their jobs, and then they come and work with us as consultants, and we do a lot of education and training across North America. The reason I'm showing you the website is also because we have a lot of additional free resources beyond what we're going to be discussing in these 12 webinars, and I invite you, when you have a minute, to go check out our resources page. We have free articles. We have videos. I recently did a TEDx talk. It's there on our YouTube channel. So there's a lot, and we'll talk more about resources as we go along. What we're also doing is we're sharing with the coalition some additional resources that will be posted on a website that you can access and download as you wish. I wrote a book on this topic called The Compassion Fatigue Workbook. It was published in 2012. And the reason I wrote this book is that I personally was starting to feel the effects of the work I was doing. I was working at Queen's University at the student counseling service there. I was also working with St. Lawrence College, which is our college here, with some of the students who had really pretty complex challenges in their lives, and some of them were struggling with some learning disabilities or some other challenges, including some mental health challenges. And I was also working with the military in Kingston, and the source of my stress, I think for many of you, you can probably relate to this, was not only hearing the difficult stories, which was one piece of it, but the other element was the frustration I felt around limited resources and growing demand. So when I worked at the counseling service, we had so many students who needed help, and we were a very small team. And so those are some of the things I became concerned about, that I was kind of noticing this depletion, this fatigue that my colleagues and I were developing, not necessarily always towards our clients or the students we were working with, but more some frustration around the system and, you know, just the complexity of the resources that were not available. And I wanted to provide a resource that was really affordable. I was getting a lot of requests from northern regions, in the Northwest Territories, for example, of folks who were living in very rural areas and did not necessarily have the funds or the resources to, you know, come to a full-day training on this topic. And so I wrote this book as an affordable resource where people can go through and do checklists and kind of walk through what's going on for them. And what I'm going to offer you in these webinars is basically taken out of that book, as well as my colleague, my co-executive director, Dr. Pat Fisher, who has been really an expert in the last 25 years on what we call organizational health. So Pat became really interested in, again, high-stress work environments and how she could make recommendations and implement some strategies to assist complicated workplaces. She's worked a lot, for example, in the prison system. How do we help our staff stay well when they're dealing with some really complex challenges? And so Pat's written two books on the topic, and again, we will be using those resources throughout the courses to kind of offer you some strategies that we know have worked elsewhere, and in fact, we've been working with the educational services in a variety of provinces, and we know that these have had good uptake, and people have found them to be useful as well. So as I mentioned before, I live in Kingston, Ontario, and some of you maybe have been here, and I like to say it's more than a Tim Hortons on the 401. We are a really interesting and kind of mixed community in the sense that, as many of you know, we are the prison capital of Canada, and I had the opportunity to work in the prison system in a variety of ways. One of them was volunteering before it closed at the Kingston Penitentiary, which, and by the way, in those days, I kind of thought was a very smart hobby to do. So I would do crisis work all day in my job, and then I would go and volunteer in a maximum security prison at night. Maybe not such a good idea in hindsight, because I was never giving myself a chance to, you know, reset. But it gave me a bit of a window into the challenges of working in the prison system, and I've had the chance of doing that subsequently, which has been really interesting. The other thing that's interesting about Kingston, which will come back again as we talk about trauma-informed care in a few sessions, is that we are a very mixed community because the prison system established itself here many years ago. A lot of families, of course, moved to be near their loved ones who are incarcerated and maybe never left. And so we've ended up having this community of a group of folks who are really struggling with complex life issues, often are living in poverty. And then we have, of course, a university and the college, and we have the Royal Military College. We have a military base. And so it's ended up bringing up some really interesting challenges. And again, I'll talk a little bit more about that as we go along as well. So As I mentioned, I worked for 10 years as a civilian for the Canadian Forces, so we have a pretty large military base here. And my job was involved in doing counseling off base, so a lot of soldiers felt more comfortable coming to see someone not on the military base for confidentiality reasons. And I did a lot of couples counseling and helping soldiers who were coming back from combat zones, maybe Afghanistan or other places. And a lot of them, of course, were struggling with some trauma or post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. And I found that job really interesting. But what I also realized over the years is that I needed more training, because when I went to school, I didn't really learn how to manage some of those really complex issues that they were coming forward with. And I eventually went and took as much training as I possibly could, every conference, every webinar, so that I could be more equipped to work with them. When I worked at Queen's University, and I worked there for 7 years with a couple of little breaks giving birth to children, I, as I mentioned, I was a crisis counselor there. And as you know, working, you know, if some of you work with the high school community, young adults, so I was working with kids who were just coming in, presents itself with some really complex challenges in terms of mental health issues, their lived experience, coming away from home. Sometimes people fall apart because they can. Or, you know, we had some very tragic events in our community and in our university, and that was kind of the nature of the work that I did. So I just wanted to give you a bit of a sense of, you know, kind of my background and the angle I've always had of trying to look at how do we support everyone equally, and how do we also deal with some of the more challenging personalities, not only in the clients or students that we work with, but also in our colleagues. And I'll definitely be talking more about that a little bit later. Attend, what we do is work with a lot of different groups. And recently, we do a lot of work with law enforcement, child trafficking, you know, some really difficult stuff. Folks who are exposed to some really difficult stories. And we also work with groups such as the Workers' Compensation Board in Alberta. I was recently there working with them. And just a real wide range of different groups that we meet. Now, in terms of these webinars, today's a bit of a, I'm giving a longer intro. Next time I'm just going to launch right into our second and third and so on, our topics. But really what we did, and we really read your surveys and designed some presentations to kind of focus on the different elements that we were hearing about. And so today we're going to talk about resilience. What does that mean? Next time we'll talk about what is compassion fatigue? What does that term even mean? How is it different from burnout? Then we'll talk about warning signs, how you can establish your own kind of personal warning sign to know how you know when you're headed for trouble and maybe intervene before that. We'll be also talking about something that I designed a few years ago called the balance map, the self-care map. We'll also talk about how to debrief when we've been exposed to a difficult story or event in the schools. We'll talk about what are grounding skills, and if you're not sure what those are, we will absolutely explain every step of the way. Grounding skills really refer to ways for us to stay centered and balanced before, during, and after being exposed to something difficult. It's an area of expertise that we have. We work, for example, with people who go into courts, and we kind of help them, support them if they're going to, you know, be in a courtroom and do some difficult stuff. Then we'll have a webinar on trauma-informed care and what that means. And if, again, you're not familiar with those terms, that's very common. A lot of folks are not. And we'll kind of give you some examples of what it means to become trauma-informed. We will have a session on working with colleagues, which can be a whole host of interesting. Then we'll talk about social support, the zone of control, how do we decide what we can focus on and what we can't, and we will finish by designing an action plan. Throughout these, we will also offer you additional resources, a little bit of a reflection activity, and at any time, please get in touch with us if you have any questions. We are always happy to answer those. So let's start with webinar number one, how to understand the basics of resilience and wellness. So I wanted to start by telling you a little story. So you're going to see here on the map that there are two little smiley faces, and one of them is kind of aimed to be somewhere near Kingston, and the other one is in the high Arctic. So I was actually, although I'm from Montreal, I was actually, my parents moved up to the High Arctic to be teachers before I was born in the early 1960s. And in fact, although I wasn't born in northern Quebec because my mom came back down, can you imagine this? She flew back down at 9 months pregnant, delivered me by herself in Montreal because the healthcare wasn't, she was worried about giving birth up north just because of the community we lived in did not have a good hospital. And then at 10 days of age, she flew back up with me and went straight back to work. And, you know, I was born in 1969, and so in those days there was no maternity leave, and her boss had said to her, you know, she said, can I take a bit of extra time off after having the baby? And he said, well, we have sick leave. You're not sick, are you? So get back on the horse. And I think that some of you, if you've been around for a while, you know that there wasn't the same level of awareness about these things in those days, and so my mom went back to work. My dad eventually became a school principal in three different northern villages, Kujawaq, Puvolnituk, and Great Whale River. And, you know, for me, growing up in the first kind of decade of my life, my normal was hearing about education reform and challenges in the schools, and, I mean, that's what we talked about at breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Eventually, my dad became superintendent, and my mom designed a training program for teachers, Inuit women, designed one of the first programs with a group of people to teach Inuit women to become teachers. So it was really kind of an interesting environment. But it was also an environment, and this is kind of the first piece I want to invite you to reflect on in terms of wellness. Because my parents were from what we call the war generation, right? So my parents were born in 1941, 1942, and I want to invite you to reflect on people you know from that generation, or if you are yourself from that generation. There was no message about work-life balance. There was no notion of self-care, of exercise, of eating spinach. And, you know, my parents' message was you work till you fall down and then you work some more. There was really no notion about those things. I always joke that, you know, my mom exercised once in 1976 and never did it again because she felt terrible after. And so part of what I want to invite you to think about as you kind of think about your reaction to even the topic of wellness is, what were the messages that you received from whoever raised you? What were the messages you received about self-care and balance? And it doesn't matter whether it was your family of origin, your foster family, your grandmother, like whoever, you know, raised you, did you get messages about that, or the message was it like me, where you just work and then you work some more? And part of that I realized, because I do a lot of these trainings, is that I realized that one of the things I grapple with all the time is feeling guilty when I'm not doing something. So think about that for a minute. And maybe some of you, this does not relate to you at all. You're like, I'm really good about taking care of myself. But even on a weekend, if I'm not, you know, actually working, I kind of always feel like I need to have a list of things I've accomplished. And I really thought about that, and I thought, you know, with no blame to my parents, I think that's a powerful message that we got from the other generation. And we know now that the younger generation, the millennials, often seem to, some of them prioritize, you know, self-care and wellness in a way that maybe some of us from another generation didn't experience, and it can cause some friction sometimes in the workplace. The second question I want to invite you to think about is, whoever is in your life, your significant others, friends, family, do they understand and value the work that you do? I think we can all agree, and it's so clear to me as I work with different educational services across the nation, that the work of people in support services is not recognized. You know, there's no TV show about you. Like, you know, we all love shows about cops and firefighters. I mean, I think that it's often a very invisible role. But what about in your personal life? Do people understand what you do? My husband is a researcher. He's not in this field at all. And one of the things I realized when I started doing this work is I needed to explain to him what a hard day meant for me, because he didn't know. You know, and I might come home and have had to deal with a terrible situation, as you, I'm sure, have experienced. And he might say, oh, I know what you mean. My computer crashed today. And I thought, oh, boy, you know, you don't get it. And so is your work valued by your significant others, friends, and family? And as I mentioned before, does society or your workplace recognize the crucial importance of the work that you do? Now, the aim here is not to necessarily get all enraged and think, you know, it's so unfair, nobody gets what we do. What I've decided over the last 20 years of doing this work is to become an advocate and also let people know. So when I'm out and about, I tell people about the work that I do. I'll say, you know, people will say, I don't really understand it. And I'll say, well, let me give you an example. So I decided to become a positive advocate to kind of explain to folks. But also in my personal life, I decided to kind of have a conversation with my loved ones who don't work in this field about what I need. So when I've come back from a tough day, I'm not necessarily going to slime my husband with graphic details of what happened, but I may say to him, I need a minute. I need, you know, transition time. I need to change. And we'll talk more about those things. And, you know, I'm not making assumptions that all of you are in relationships. This might be your best friend. It might be your kids. But all of us, you know, live in a society and in a world, and kind of inviting us to reflect on what messages did you receive. Is it okay to take care of ourselves in our personal life? And also, do people understand the work that we do? So why did I become interested in this topic of burnout and related symptoms? I was a clinician, as I mentioned to you, and yes, I was stressed, and yes, the work was challenging, and you know, I definitely noticed that my view of the world had changed because of this work. So after working with college and university students, you know, hundreds of them, I stopped believing that there was anyone healthy out there. And I don't know if that makes sense for you. I kind of forgot that maybe some people go to school and don't have an eating disorder, or maybe some people don't have a learning disability. My view of the world became pretty, you know, jaded in a sense. But I also became concerned with the burnout I was seeing in people I worked with, some of my colleagues, so maybe other counselors, some of the healthcare workers. You know, sometimes I'd have to take a suicidal student to the hospital, and some of them were amazing, and some of them were really not great at all. And I started really thinking to myself, surely to goodness, none of us went into this field because we didn't like other people. What could we do so that we can improve our working conditions and the way that we treat the people who turn to us for support? And that includes our colleagues, of course. So Dr. Fisher's work has been so fascinating to me because she started doing work on what are called high-stress jobs. Now, I'm sure you could all, if we were face-to-face, we could all make a list of jobs that we've done in the past that were stressful, but we're not in this field. At some point, I worked, you know, I went to high school, and I it's a long story, but I left home really young, and I put myself through school, and so I was in high school, and at night I would work in a really busy restaurant till 1 o'clock in the morning, and any of you who've done those jobs, we can agree those are stressful jobs. But we started realizing that although there are a lot of stressful jobs out there, not all of these jobs have the added element of exposure to trauma. And I want to explain here Dr. Fisher's model, because I truly believe that working in educational services has a component that many people in society don't even realize, that you actually do high stress, high trauma exposed work. So the model looks like this. Systemic workplace stress is just the stress of every kind of job you can imagine. You could imagine working, at some point I worked as a secretary in a really busy research center. It was a stressful job. There was job stress. There was certain elements of burnout. There was some workplace harassment stuff going on. That can happen anywhere. What's really interesting and really important for all of us before we start these webinars, for all of us to understand, is we cannot exclude, or we need to not forget, that we, all of us and all of you, have certain elements of trauma exposure in your job. Now, we can agree that that can be, as we call it, big T trauma or little T trauma. Not all of you are exposed in the same way. Just like I think you would agree with me that working as a child internet sexual exploitation investigator is definitely a more trauma-exposed job than certain other jobs, like working in a nursing home. So, of course, there's varying degrees. But the more we understand what is the element of our job that is the traumatic piece, what we started realizing in our research is that that is considered an amplifier. A lot of the exposure we have amplifies our stress level, makes us more reactive to certain things, and I'll give examples as we go on. Now, trauma exposure can look like two things. One of them is what we call direct trauma. Direct trauma is you are assaulted, you witness an assault, you know, something really, first responders, of course, are exposed to a lot of that. If you worked, any of you worked with child protection services in the past, if you go into a home to apprehend a child and you're in danger, those are direct exposure. But, you know, a lot of staff are physically assaulted on the job, and we know that. The same is true, by the way, with nurses. Many nurses have been assaulted on the job. So those are all called direct exposure. But then there's all the indirect stuff, and I'll talk more about that in our second webinar. All the stuff that you didn't see, but as I like to say, it's like in the ventilation system. We hear about it, we talk to each other about it, and how are we impacted by those things? So that's the first piece that we need to understand. I'll go back to the model later, but our jobs are unique. They're very different than working in, you know, a factory or in a busy real estate office or what have you. And the more we understand that piece, the more we can implement strategies that work for us. It's also why sometimes, you know, I like to say, giving every staff member in a clinic or in a school a stress ball is not going to fix all the complex issues that are going on. It's a nice gesture, but it's 1% or not even 1% of the solution. So one of the things that we need to do is we need to start with the basics. And the basics are that although I know that sometimes being told to take good care of ourselves can be incredibly frustrating, because some people will sometimes say to me, don't tell me to sleep more and exercise. I know those things. The thing that's interesting about them, though, is that we do need to start with the basics so that we can physically do the work that we do. I'll give you a very simple example. Not everyone needs a lot of sleep, by the way. My partner needs a lot less sleep than me. But I know that when I, in order to be on the top of my game, if I can, if I'm not interrupted by sick kids and all the things that interrupt our sleep, I need a lot of sleep in order to be on my A game. And so we know that self-care is something that a lot of us know about. But one of the things that's been really interesting in the last few years is looking at what are the physiological impact of being depleted. There was a study done in Israel a few years ago that found that judges were much more likely to grant an offender parole after lunch than before lunch. So if you think about that, what that means is that basically they just needed to eat. You know, their blood sugar was low and it was affecting their ability to make good decisions. So we also need to understand, what do we mean when we say stress? So there's a lot of research on stress that's been going on for the last 30 years. And what was highlighted is there's a big difference between positive stress, we call it eustress, E-U, eustress, which is basically stress that all of us could have under positive situations. Eustress could be you're getting married. I think that if any of you have done that, it's a pretty stressful event. You just had a baby. You have a presentation to give, and you're not terrified, but you're definitely, you know, stressed about it. So there are lots of positive situations that can cause stress, but it's not necessarily negative stress. And then, of course, we know about distress, which is caused by senses of threat or discomfort from, you know, things that are actually stressing us out. There's some really interesting research done about, for example, some events that might look like a positive event, but that are actually very stressful. There was some research done that winning the lottery, although it sounds like an amazing thing, is probably one of the most stressful and negative events that can happen in people's lives. Another one that was found was transitions, so retirement, a child leaving home. Those transitions are actually considered to be very stressful events, even though they may look like they're exciting. So we kind of need to tease out a little bit. You know, not all stress is negative, but it can absolutely have an impact on us. So the way to explain this is kind of the usual curve that we show. Stress is not always a bad thing. So So can we agree that having deadlines, I don't know about you, but, you know, if I don't have deadlines, I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to watch Netflix or go outside for a walk. So having a certain amount of stress gets us to do certain things. But when we have too much stress, then our performance is impacted and then we are less effective. And so we've seen this in a many variety of workplaces where when there is too much stress on people, and I'm sure you've experienced that, our performance is affected and then we're no longer problem solving very well. So I'll give you an example of that. I don't know if you've ever had to make a really quick decision based on, you know, maybe something was going on, and I'll give you an example. Your family lives half across the country, and all of a sudden you get bad news and you have to really quickly decide, do I go? Do I, you know, book a time? Do I book time off? Do I travel? Do I get a plane ticket? Can I afford that? Who's going to take care of the dogs? You know, in those moments, we are not only stressed, but we're in distress, and we're not making this kind of rational problem solving that we might in other circumstances. You might have found that with other people where you were really calm, you had a friend in crisis, and you helped them kind of break down, okay, what do you need to do first, and then next, and then next. And so what we've recognized is that too much stress leads to problem solving breakdown. So we're not as able to talk to colleagues. We're not as able to make good decisions because our body is basically in a state of we're full of stress hormones and we are just not able to solve problems in the same way. We're going to talk more about this as we go through. And so basically, finally, just a couple more points. There's another concept that's really interesting, and it's called the state of flow. Now, this was designed by a guy who has this unpronounceable name, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. I can't even say his name. Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. Anyways, Mihaly somebody. And he talked about flow being this state where we are completely, like we're busy, but we're so engaged that we lose track of time and place. I'm going to give you two really quick examples of that. Some people talk about that when they play sports. They call it being in the zone. And if you've played sports, maybe you can relate to this. Or maybe another activity you love. So I'm not a very good gardener, but I love to pull weeds. I find it super satisfying. And when I do that, I can literally lose track of time. I also get in a state of flow when I'm sometimes involved working with children. And I know that a lot of you love that part of your job more than anything. Are there certain things that where you are literally in a state of flow? You're not bored, you're not tired, you lose track of time because you're so engaged in what you do. Some artists talk about that. I mean, there's a million examples. Some people talk about going fishing. Now, what's interesting about that is, you know, some people hate fishing and they would not be in a state of flow while they're doing it. So it's just a really interesting concept to think about. What is the difference between when you're in a state of flow and when you're in a state of distress where you are not problem solving very well and you're not actually at your best performance? So just to conclude, what we're kind of referring to, because I'm sure a lot of you have heard the word resiliency before, in the context of these webinars, resiliency refers to strengthening ourselves for when the going gets tough, because we can agree that we do challenging jobs and every day you're on your feet. I mean, many of you talked about, you know, you're on the go from like the bell rings until the bell rings again. So strengthening ourselves for when the going gets tough, how can we do that? And the other concept of resiliency is bouncing back from challenging situations. And we're going to talk a lot more about that because it's something, there's some really interesting research about bouncing back. And we're going to talk more about what that looks like in a variety of ways and how we can develop better ways to bounce back. So we're also referring to building what we call our resiliency bank. And how do we implement certain things so that when things are challenging, maybe you've had a challenging situation at work and you have a caregiver role at home. You know, maybe, so right now, for example, my husband has pneumonia. So I've been trying to take care of him. Yes, I gave it to him. Take care of him, not getting as much sleep as possible, having challenging work environments. And how do we build our bank for when situations, you know, are less than optimal? So here's my question to you as we conclude this webinar. What do you come home to every day? You know, do you come home to more demands? And I think a lot of folks in our fields do. We have a lot of caregiver demands. How do we reset ourselves? And how do we transition from chaos to hopefully peace, but maybe more chaos? What are the activities that you do? Do you change clothes, for example? Some people have said that coming home and changing clothes is this really simple way for them to reset and feel like they've kind of put school behind them. If you have pets, do you go walk your dog? Is that your transition activity? Do you come home to more demands and maybe you don't have a transition activity? And we're going to talk about that as we discuss self-care strategies as well. So today was just a really quick overview. We're going to kind of dig deep into all of those elements as we go through it. But I just wanted to give you an overall model of what we do, how we recognize that this is not a quick fix. There's no magic bullet. There's no squeeze stress ball that's going to fix all of this. But what we found in the work that we do, and we work with folks who do the kind of work you do every single day, we have been able to offer different strategies and solutions that are realistic and achievable for each one of us in a different way. And so that's what we're going to do throughout these webinars. I hope you'll find them interesting and helpful to you. If at any point you have questions, here is our email address. Do not hesitate to get in touch. We welcome questions. And just so you know, the questions you send us at our email address are confidential, and those are just between you and us. We will not be sharing those with the group as a whole. So here we go. That was the end of webinar one, and I'll see you next time.